The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
Councillor Fry, it's great to have you here back on The Pulse on CFRO.
Yeah, thanks, David. Good to be here.
Yeah, happy New Year. How have you been?
Happy New Year to you, too. I'd be lying if I said I've been good. It's been a tough year. And you know, the holidays, you know, because I have there's a lot of burden of kind of responsibility in this job. And it's the stress didn't go away just because the holidays were here. So I'm sure looking forward to the end of this pandemic. That's all I can really say.
I think we can all agree with you on that.
Yeah. I'm certainly, keeping my chin up and soldiering on, but it's definitely taking its toll. I think I can confidently say that for everybody on council. We're all pretty frayed and overworked and stressed out.
Yeah, I get Zoom burnout. Like, I got friends across the country who are always wanting to have Zoom hangouts, and I'm just kind of done. I do it occasionally just to show my face, but you guys have to do your jobs every council meeting with just Zoom screens and speakers lined up by internet queue.
Yeah, you know, we've actually, the interesting thing is there was a lot of concern around how our new system would work because people couldn't come to City Hall and speak in person. I think actually what the new system has done is made it even easier for folks to speak to council because now we have an operator. Whereas before you would have to go and sit around City Hall and it could be hours waiting for your item to come up and your opportunity to speak. Now we have an operator that calls you about 5 minutes before you're scheduled to appear before council. So it's a very low barrier for folks to attend and speak to us. So it means that we hear a lot more people.
Mm. Do you sometimes miss kind of seeing the usual suspect faces? Like there's some people who are always commenting and present, you know, at council meetings or journalists in the front row or the same people every time.
Definitely.
That you've got to miss that.
Miss that. And actually, you know, one of the other things that I really do miss my colleagues on council. You know, there was a real sort of calming element to the fact that we had, you know, we'd have to break bread together. And so we would share meals together. We'd have a little snack table in the back and meet in front of the coffee machine or whatever. And I think that actually does a lot to mitigate some of the kind of tension that otherwise might be there in our day-to-day business. So it's a lot easier to be snappy at somebody on the other side of a computer screen. Different when you're face-to-face and you're in the same physical room as somebody.
Now, I wondered if we could look back over the last year a little bit, because I know that we've had this pandemic, we've had a lot of pressure on the city to help out the small businesses, to be responsive on issues around the pandemic. We've got the opioid crisis. Is there anything that over the last year that you kind of take from 2020 in hindsight?
You know, just how fragile our systems are and how, I mean, this has been a real test of systems, not just, you know, in Vancouver or in government, but in all forms of systems. And that something as simple as this could absolutely derail so much of what we take for granted. So I think that it does, you know, I think we're still playing catch up and obviously we're trying to kind of get ourselves into a recovery. Although with the virus mutating and still sort of, you know, a pretty long runway to get folks vaccinated, recovery still seems like a ways away. But as we move towards recovery, I think building our systems to be more resilient is going to be the key. And that's something that, you know, we've tossed around a lot. And of course, Vancouver was named as, you know, one of the Rockefeller resilient cities. Money was put into resilience. But I think a lot of the resilience that we were looking at were really things like, you know, systemic inequities, and then, you know, like your garden variety disasters like earthquakes or something like that.
I know isolation was on the radar around the resiliency conversation as well, which is fascinating now in retrospect.
Well, you know, and what's interesting is that the provincial disaster response framework didn't even consider a pandemic. So, you know, this is relatively, it surprises me actually. I mean, in retrospect and looking back, but there wasn't a lot of planning and disaster management planning around a pandemic. And you know, now we know obviously that is a gap, and we can see real world implications of where we could improve some of those systems. I mean, one of the biggest ones for me that's been most profound is how it's impacted housing precarity. So, you know, obviously folks who are you know, unable to work or have lost their jobs, and the threat of eviction and that piece to it, but also how we shelter people. So we've had a real challenge with people who are unhoused because they can't be in a shelter system, because where we would normally put four people in a certain square meter and bunks and what have you, we can't do that with physical distancing and COVID. So it's put a lot more stress on the limited facilities we had to shelter people who were unhoused. Layered on top of that, a lot of the housing, the precarious housing, so the people who are technically homeless but are couch surfing or, you know, flopping at a friend's SRO, a lot of those people became sort of a collateral damage as you know, buildings sort of cracked down on visitors and physical distancing meant that you couldn't just crash on somebody's couch the way you might have.
I know, talking to a lot of housing providers and nonprofits here in the Downtown East Side where we broadcast, they had to make difficult choices. For instance, I know First United had to basically close down its daytime living room space that was so essential for day sleeping and accessing showers and things, because they needed that space for housing. And I know a lot of other people had to make kind of those triage decisions as well to get people off the street.
Yeah, I mean, I find it troubling, to be honest with you, if, you know, on this side of the equation. I mean, obviously, when we deal with housing and homelessness, we work with the province a lot and the feds. And it boggles the mind to me that we haven't been able to really activate emergency shelter systems more rapidly. And that instead, we see people sleeping rough in the streets or in parks like Strathcona. The fact of the matter is, I mean, if this was any other kind of, you know, if this was a natural disaster like an earthquake and large swaths of the population were rendered homeless because their buildings were destroyed or damaged, the army would show up and we would have giant tent systems deployed and we would have systems in place, I would hope. The fact that we haven't been able to kind of activate on that level is deeply disturbing to me and a great source of frustration. And again, it's one of those things that we're working with the province. And of course, we had a provincial election just recently, and that put a real damper on the province and BC Housing activating a lot of resources. But still, it's slow moving, and it's frustrating for me as somebody who comes from the private sector, where we would just make it happen. Like, I've been self-employed prior to this my entire life, and by hook or by crook, we would make things happen when they needed to happen. And I would pull all-nighters and I would do whatever it takes in my business. And so for me, it's tough to grapple with how slowly government works sometimes.
Do you think in the last year, though, that city council has kind of realized there are more levers in its possession than it thought it had? I know, for instance, we'd love an update on this plan to purchase hotels. I know that two were purchased by the city, Regent and Balmoral, but there's plans for dozens more. Is that something that was off the table before that's now possible? It seems like there are a lot of things the city has done that it could have done.
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's important to contextualize that actually what we're doing is almost outside of our jurisdiction. I mean, the role of housing provision is the province's. The province, just the same as they do education, social services and welfare, health administration.
Of course, the brunt of the costs of dealing with homelessness fall on municipalities.
Well, and that's the issue. So we are a little bit stepping out of our comfort zone, I would say, when we start looking at purchasing hotels. This is an unprecedented move in many respects, because typically the expectation would be for the province to step in and do that. And the province have the financial tools to do that. They have a larger tax base than we do. They have the ability to allocate a lot of taxes. You know, at the end of the day, as a city, we have fees and property taxes. And obviously our fees have been greatly compromised by the pandemic, but it's a challenge because, you know, in the previous civic government, the Vision of Vancouver, they had made a very bold promise to end homelessness. And that was never really the city's jurisdiction. And they kind of ended up wearing that to make a promise like that was really we don't have the resources to achieve that. And even if we did, you know, obviously homelessness is a provincial and regional issue as much as it is a Vancouver issue. So, you know, I'm very appreciative of the fact that we are moving in the right direction and we are looking at purchasing and expropriating hotels like the Regent and the Balmoral. We still need to work with the province on that, though. I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of the funding is going to come from the province and the feds, including the operating budget. So,
yeah. I mean, what is it that you'd like to see in the year ahead on housing issues specifically?
Well, I'd like to see us really just, you know, honestly, just stabilize where the housing precarity is, because I think that's the critical issue. I feel like we're still sort of in a triage position where we're sort of trying to staunch some of the bleeding out of the city that is happening. So I'd like to see us kind of get things a little bit more stabilized and then start working on items that are of a more just recovery. And I think that's going to take a very different look at, in particular, we have the Vancouver plan that's going on and determining the future of the city and how it works with recovery are going to be critical to that notion of what a just recovery is and for who, and how do we grow our city and for who. And I think we're, you know, where the pandemic has stretched and stressed a lot of those resources, it's also presented some opportunities. What we've seen, obviously, is with the reduction in tourism and foreign language students, it's actually relieved some of the pressure on the housing vacancy market. So it's given us a bit of an opportunity to maybe recalibrate and catch up a little bit. And I think that this will be an opportunity to, as we recover, we can kind of recalibrate some of the systems, in particular in the housing, that have been skewed the wrong way.
Now, I think one of the barriers and challenges that we can all probably agree on is that this level of polarization in our societies has kind of permeated everywhere from the U.S. Capitol, as we saw in horror this week, to the streets of our city with journalists getting punched at a pro-Trump rally at the art gallery last week, to, you know, city councils and municipal governments. I'm wondering what your take is on this. We had some discussion this week on Twitter about whether what happened at the U.S. Capitol was akin to a 2017 takeover of council chambers by housing protesters. What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, that was an embarrassingly bad take, I thought. To compare the two, I mean, there's absolutely no comparison. The takeover at City Hall that happened was uncomfortable for sure. I wasn't on council at the time, but there was no sort of racist symbology, or there weren't people showing up with nooses and Confederate flags. There wasn't violence and wanton destruction of property.
No police officers were bludgeoned with fire extinguishers.
Exactly. Nobody died. There was no attempt to violently overthrow City Hall. It was a sit-in protest that made some people uncomfortable, and it may have gotten a bit out of hand in a few places, but I mean, not even remotely comparable, not even comparable to something like the Stanley Cup riot. I mean, we've seen far more egregious things happen in our city than a few poverty activists.
Yeah, I'll read those tweets just for context of our listeners. Former councillor George Affleck said that day in 2017, when City of Vancouver City Hall chamber was taken by protesters and democratic process was halted. Among those who took our seats was Order of Canada recipient and now city councillor Gene Swanson. His colleague on the NPA, still a councillor, Melissa DeGeneva, said, in a democracy, storming and shutting down a Congress, legislature, or even a city council is never the right thing to do in Washington or Vancouver. The same group chased council down the street. Swanson led that one too. I mean, you say monumentally bad take on Twitter. Is it just about the cause? Is it about the violence? Is it, to you, what is the wrongness of this comparison?
It's also a little bit about the dog whistle. You know,
say more about that.
Well, DeGeneva's tweet, for one thing, referred to Speaker Pelosi as Pelosky. Pelosky is apparently some kind of alt-right slight to suggest that she's a communist or something like that. So it's kind of a meme that has been captured by the alt-right.
I just thought it was a typo.
It happens to be a typo that is used to malign the Speaker of the House as a communist. So perhaps it was a typo, or it was an autocorrect based on browsing history. I have no idea. But my, you know, I think that in making that comparison, it really glossed over the white supremacist nature of the insurrection at the Capitol this week. And I think that's where it was completely off base to make the comparison. And we've been hearing a lot of troubling stuff from the board of the NPA party. Of course, one of the members is a quote unquote journalist for Rebel News.
That term is used very loosely when it comes to the Rebel.
I did quote unquote. I was air quoting as I said that. And another is a Trump supporting anti-mask activist. So there's some troubling characters who are on the NPA board already, and there's some troubling rhetoric that's been coming out of the board. You know, I do for the most part find that the NPA caucus is not reflective of the board.
In fact,
that
to their credit, several of the NPA councillors have criticized the board's decisions and elections.
Yeah, no, for sure, and I regularly acknowledge that and appreciate that about them. However, that said, this particular tweet narrative really kind of strayed back into that territory, and I think it was important to call it out, also because it reflects poorly on the rest of us at council if we don't specifically call that kind of characterization out.
I wanted to ask you, Pete. You know, I assume that you were glued to your screen last week during the Capitol riots, as most of us probably were in horror. But for yourself, as an elected official and also as a person of color in politics, who kind of was, you know, people were targeting those senators and congresspeople in Washington. What was your feeling watching all this unfold?
You know, what's interesting is for the most part, I was super swamped with some working files that I was doing. So I was only peripherally catching it up, but I knew what was happening. And it was only later that I got a chance to sit down and sort of watch the visuals and that was, even though I knew what to expect, that was quite terrifying actually to just see. I think the most striking one for me was the lone black cop, being chased up the stairs, and just as the horde kind of started coming around the corner, and just the feeling that must have been going through his head, and, you know, with all this imagery of people with nooses and Confederate flags. I think we're unlikely to see a character like Donald Trump reemerge anytime soon in North America. I think that I thought a lot about this because, you know, I've spoken to people, and I know people who would kind of be Trump supportish, you know, if there was an option like that here in Canada, who kind of agreed with a lot of what he had to say, maybe not everything, but like that America first and, like, you know, trade there was a lot that resonated with them. But I think this would have been a bridge too far for most of those people, as I think about it, that this became just this sort of thuggery, you know, Kristallnacht kind of goon squad thing that leaves a really troubling troubling collective memory of what happened in Germany in the 1930s, frankly. And I think as we reflect on that, I think that it will probably, I think it'll actually snap a lot of people back into their senses, hopefully, if we can get past some of this bifurcation and this really horrible polarization and the antagonism that's going on. I think in the healing that we'll see roll out in the United States, hopefully, and of course, whatever happens in the United States will ripple across to us. I think that there'll be a sober second thought, and people will realize that Trump was a madman that was leading the United States into a very, very dark, dark and dangerous place.
Part of the problem, I think, is that we have such a no longer a shared grasp of what the facts and reality are. And even after the Congress raids, you have this division between people trying to explain the action, saying, well, they were, you know, there's economic anxiety, and largely people of color. On the other hand, saying these people were carrying Confederate flags, head nooses, were literally targeting police officers and Congress people of color, that there was such a racist overtone that it's very hard to imagine healing in the same way that after the Civil War there, they must, you know, there was talk of healing. And at some point you have to acknowledge accountability.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. But I think that the Nazi Germany folks, just regular working German people, just got kind of caught up in the movement. And it had a profound impact on the collective German psyche after the war, when folks really were able to step back and take that sober second look at how caught up they had been in this madness, and how despicable and disgusting their collective behavior had been, and the great shame that came with that. And I think that we're seeing that, hopefully, that moment kind of crystallize now for Americans who, I mean, of course, there will always be these fringy, angry lunatics who will continue to, you know, spout this QAnon kind of conspiracy stuff and dangerous rhetoric. And there will always be racists and intolerant bigots in society. But I think that that veneer of acceptability that we saw when a sitting U.S. president had effectively endorsed that kind of behavior and sanctioned that kind of behavior, I think that's where we'll see the change, and it will go back to being more fringy and generally frowned upon in polite society. And I hope that that is where we are collectively heading as we kind of shake off this horrible bad dream of the last 4 years of Trump.
Last question for you, counselor, is any resolutions for 2021 for you personally?
The wife and I are going to get an exercise machine. Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, like,
we're not getting out of our houses really anytime soon is what you're saying.
Exactly. You know, and just realizing that we're going to have to, you know, take a little bit better care of ourselves. I definitely need to take a little bit better care of my physical health. I mean, I'm fine, but I've just been working too hard and too stressed out and not exercising enough, and realizing that that, you know, it's a long haul. And I think, you know, if my advice to anybody who's listening out there who's kind of in a similar boat, it's important to take care of your physical health. And I've realized that over these holidays that I'm just burning myself out, and I'm no good to anybody if I get burned out. But there's a lot to do, so I feel compelled to keep doing it. But I realize that there's a lot of self-care that has to go into this. So that's my big resolution, is to kind of practice a bit more self-care.
I guess that's a good message for all of us. Well, thank you so much, Counselor Fry, for talking to us. Great to have you on, Pete.
David, great to hear from you.
Yeah.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too. And that was Vancouver City Councilor Pete Fry.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.